Hello and welcome to Politics Weekly, your regular diet of dialogue and diatribes.
Joining us today are our top columnist and pod regular, Madeleine Bunting, as well as Cambridge University's most thought-provoking politics don, David Runciman.
Well, we'll talk about politics present very soon, TV debates and the sway of big money. But first, we turn to politics past. This week brought news that Labour's great tribune through the wilderness years, Michael Foot, had died at 96. Here's Simon Hoggart and Michael White to reminisce.
Well, Michael Foot is best seen as a magnificent throwback to the 18th century.
He was kind of hard to get to know in a way. If you asked him a direct question, he'd say, yes, well, yes, very good, very good. What he liked more than anything else in all the world was to be curled up with a book. The house was, it was almost impossible to move for books.
He'd slap his thigh and say, well, there you are, there you have it, and go off on some other tangent. But life was never dull, and very important, he wasn't a Puritan.
The Tories put it about sometime after Thatcher became Prime Minister that the person they feared most as leader of the Labour Party was Michael Foot, because he looked like a statesman, he looked like a man of wisdom, experience and honesty. And of course he was all those things, but they also realised, because they were very, very good at public images, that he was someone who looked like a doddering old geezer. And so you have this bizarre thing that when he went to the Cenotaph as leader of the Labour Party, he was wearing what was described very unkindly as a donkey jacket, but was actually his rather pathetic attempt to look rather smart, rather trim. His wife had bought him this new coat just for the occasion. And of course, he looked like Michael Foot wearing a donkey jacket.
The liberty of the press in this country can only be maintained by the vigilance of the people and the vigilance of Parliament and the courage of the newspapers themselves. That's the only way. Therefore, we must fight, fight, fight to retain those liberties.
Some of the funniest speeches I've ever heard in the House of Commons were from Michael Foot. In the past, in his youth, he had spoken, if you look at the old stuff, scowling, enraged, his face twisted with hatred for whoever he was attacking, whether it was people who wanted more atomic weapons or Conservatives generally.
It is a mighty upsurge of democratic protest.
That was the style you had in those days. You had to look like Lenin on top of a soapbox somewhere or speaking from the walls of the Kremlin. In fact, inside, he was a very gentle, very humorous man.
Michael liked to drink, he liked to eat well, he liked the company of pretty girls. He was devoted to his wife, Jill, married to her for 50 years. He had a great life. The only drawback was that most of his great political causes were defeated one way or another. The one good thing from Foot's point of view was that he was succeeded as leader by his young protégé, Neil Kinnock, who set about reforming the Labour Party and led, more than anybody, to Tony Blair winning those elections in the 90s.
Madeleine, it's weird because Mike Blair is saying his causes were defeated, but in many ways, Larry Elliott's writing in the paper today that his ideas are quite timely now. Some of the ideas in the 83 manifesto, like, you know, nationalising banks, for instance, are quite kind of they're quite modern ideas.
Yeah, Seamus's column was tackling something of those issues as well, and it made me kind of reflect on why it was that my political coming of age was Michael Foot's time, and why it was that he completely failed to appeal to me. And Simon Hoggart just said it just then: scowling, enraged, hatred, scornful. He was an angry man, and I can understand now, looking back at, you know, as an adult, what he was angry about. The early 1980s was the breakdown of the post-war consensus and the rise of unemployment, and that for him, that would have brought back all the memories of the 1930s.
I mean, do you see that, David, or do you sort of get more of the sort of Hazlitt scholar, the lifelong rebel, and the kind of duffel coat donner, which has been the dominant strain in the media stuff?
Listening to those clips, what struck me was his speaking style sounds prehistoric. And
like
reading the obituaries, he first stood for Parliament when Baldwin was Prime Minister.
1935.
And he is someone, you hear that and you realise he grew up without microphones, and it's that shrieking, hectoring style, which even in the 1980s sounded like it came from pre-war world. I mean, that's a 75-year political life this man had.
Yes.
And just in terms of that presentation, and how you speak, he was out of time even when he became leader of the party. That's really striking about it.
It's the whole transition from microphones and also the intimacy of a political culture mediated through television. So you actually, Tony Blair would always talk as if, you know, he'd just bumped into you at the bar. That kind of intimacy, it's a fake intimacy, obviously, of political culture, but that's what we're now used to. And Foote, of course, was not. It was absolutely, you had to really yell.
Political life that went from Baldwin to Obama, and just in terms of how politicians come across to the public, that is an unimaginable shift.
Because for someone like me, I listen to the screaming and I sort of think, okay, turn it down a bit. But I would like to hear a bit more of that. Yeah. I mean, do we know now that we're going to have these three TV debates? And these guys, apart from Brown, the two of them, that Clegg and Cameron, look very similar and speaking very similar stuff. I'd quite like them to lose their rag a bit, and they won't. There won't be anyone screaming like Michael Foote.
Yeah, the rag losing goes on in private now. In public, they all have to sound nice because we live in the age of the nice. Michael Foote was clearly an incredibly nice man, yet his public persona was not that. It was of an angry man. He's like the reverse of how our politicians are now.
Are you looking forward to the TV debates?
No. I feel I have to watch them. I'm slightly dreading it. Three of them, 90 minutes.
Madeline, do you think, Gordon Brown took this chance because he thought he was well behind of having a TV debate, but do you think he's got the kind of character that's liable to come well through in this kind of a thing?
Well, the kind of general rule on this consensus is that, you know, Brown always looks terribly glum and dour on the television, and, you know, smiles are desperately forced. But I think there are real risks for all of them. I mean, Cameron's clearly got a real risk, which is that if he comes across as too sort of smarmy and smooth, that's going to not play well for him as well. I think that actually Brown has just as much chance as Cameron of benefiting from these debates.
Really?
Yeah, I think so, because Cameron's not very
quick either.
He's airbrushed, you know, he's so airbrushed, and everybody has this sort of, oh, is he spin or is he really, you know, is there an authenticity there?
The TV debates that he did the debate in the leadership contest that he did well in was when he sort of, he did particularly one in the last one, but he's good at no notes. He's not so good at quick repartee.
But Madeline, I'm really interested in this because my feeling on the whole thing is that, and the classic case was Kennedy getting the edge on Nixon back in 1960 when they first had them in the US because Nixon was sweating, that these are really about style and not substance, but you seem to see them as an actual opportunity for the lack of substance in the conservative platform to come through.
I wouldn't say it's substance. I think these are all about character. That's what these debates are about. You know, does someone stay cool or do they look wobbly or whatever? How do they handle confrontation and conflict? And I think that we've had, you know, some very, very adept media operators, of which Blair is one and Cameron is the other. And I think people are very kind of unconvinced now about those kinds of very suave, sophisticated media skills. So what Cameron's challenge is going to have to be is how do you convey authenticity? And that's just as steep a climb for him as how does Brown convey humanity?
Now, that's an interesting point, isn't it, David? Do you think there'll be a way that Cameron can look authentic on these things? How would you go about it?
To me, what's interesting about it is we're so used to these presidential debates, and this is a three-way debate, and the dynamic is completely different because what the public seem to respond to in these things is they pick up when someone is being picked on. I mean, it's who gangs up on who against the third that's going to shape the dynamic of these things. If these two young men gang up on Gordon, Gordon actually might look like he's rising above it. On the other hand, if Brown and Clegg gang up on Cameron, and in a way, I think each of them is going to want to be the one who's being squeezed by the other two. It's completely different from a two-way debate. And I think that's the thing that's so striking about this, that we've got these three-way debates. I don't think anyone knows how that side of it's going to play out.
Well, for more on these two very different issues, Michael Foote's death and also the TV debates, we have special pages on our website, guardian.co.uk.
Now, some housekeeping news. We're taking Politics Weekly on the road in the run-up to the election. First stop, Manchester, where we'll be wielding big guns, including Polly Toynbee, Michael White and John Harris. And to come along and pitch your own questions, go to guardian.co.uk/politicsweekly and click on the link. Tickets are £5.
Now, Madeline, last week you wrapped up a massive project for The Guardian called Citizens Ethics. Can you give us a little bit about it?
Yeah, it was started off really with Michael Sandel's Wreath lectures for the BBC last May, when he said we really need to take back into the public domain, into political culture, a set of what are primarily ethical questions, that politics can never really be separated from ethical issues, and that over the last 25 years, there's been a very dangerous tendency to just pretend that politics has, you know, can be done simply on the basis of efficiency or managerialist. What is the most effective managerial outcome? So a whole raft of questions have really been left to the market to decide. You know, how should people get paid? The market will decide. Actually, how people get paid is crucial to our political economy, and that at heart, that is an ethical issue. How do you decide people's value and worth?
Well, the project culminated in an event at the British Museum last week called Who Deserves What? Harvard's Michael Sandel kicked off the debate, but he didn't fully persuade the economist Diane Coyle.
It's been common to the theory and also the practice of democratic politics, I think on both sides of the Atlantic, in recent decades, that it's safer, healthier, to keep moral and religious questions at a certain distance from democratic politics. So it seems to me we need to reinvigorate democratic political argument by being more hospitable to the moral convictions that citizens actually do care about. We need what might be described as a more faith-friendly form of democratic public discourse.
The thing that worries me as a secular woolly liberal right. about your proposition is that people who bring religious conviction do have a conviction. They're much more certain about what they think than I am, and they have the power of institutions and organisations behind it. And so your proposition seems to me idealistic, actually, unworkable.
David, first question with the Michael Sandel hypothesis, which is roughly that the ethics has been taken out of politics, is, do you think that's true? He's talking about both sides of the Atlantic, but things like abortion run pretty large in the US, don't they?
Yeah, I think his American perspective on it, this is about religion, and I entirely sympathise with that view that you would get from the United States, that it's religion or the market, and what's been squeezed out is something ethical that isn't either of those two things. I'm not sure how it translates over to here. But I can certainly see it because, apart from anything else, British politics is lagging behind America but catching up in this respect. I don't think our politics is becoming more religious, but there is more of that feel about our politics that the people with the most passionate convictions, wherever they come from, are the ones who are colonising the kind of ethical sphere, and the woolly liberals are being squeezed out.
That's interesting. Madeline's agreeing.
Well, I'm not here talking about religious. I'm actually saying let's clear the space for a discussion about ethics, which woolly liberals are just as kind of involved in and just as engaged in as anybody else. I don't think this is about people bringing their religious beliefs into the public sphere so much as let's have an ethical conversation about how bankers are walking away with billion-pound bonuses or whatever. And that is actually about how we value people. And I think loads of people can join that conversation, whether they have religious beliefs or not. So, you know, I think Sandel, absolutely, as David says, is seeing this as in a very American way, and that is much more religious culture than we are. So I'm not talking about religion here. I'm talking about what Mary Warnock was describing, which is that we need to get back to using an ethical language, which is actually very familiar when you start thinking about it.
What would that look and sound like, Madeline, if you had a prime minister in your own moulding? How would they talk? I mean, you have sort of someone like in your publication that came out at the same time as the event, there were some commentators who were talking about the certitude, the moral certitude of the Thatchers and the Blairs is actually became its own problem.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this kind of ethical language is already latent in many, many parts of our political culture now over the last couple of years, as David says. Because when people say this is outrageous, that the kind of huge levels
of
disparities between top-level pay and average earnings, what is that outrage about? And, you know, Sandel made this really clear in the debate last week, that ultimately that is a response to justice. This is unjust. And in a way, Foote is a very kind of relevant thing here, because I think he did have a profoundly kind of moral view of politics and drew on that for his anger. So this is about how do you engage people's emotions and give them a language. Now, what we've seen over the last 18 months is a real sense of outrage about the MP scandal, a sense of entitlement that you could just claim anything you liked as long as it was within the law, and a sense of outrage about inequality, that Labour, after 13 years, has failed failed to really substantially reduce inequality. Social mobility is stuck. You know, it's not fair. It's not fair. Now, that is an ethical concept. It's not fair. So I'm saying that's the debate we actually need to be having, and it's an ethical debate. Accept it as an ethical debate, because it's about ideas of justice and the worth of human people and what political economy should be designed to do.
Is it, David, something that, if Madeleine says this is the arguments we're already having, Goodwin's pension's outrageous, Michael Ashcroft, who maybe will come into a moment, lack of public service is outrageous, would it make any odds if we actually imported the language of morality and ethics? Or do you think it's just what matters is the substantive things we talk about?
Well, I entirely agree. We need to have the substantive argument about justice. My anxiety about bringing in the language of ethics is that it tends to refocus back on character. And I think we almost spend too much time already. We've been doing it in this programme, talking about the character of politicians.
But isn't it different to talk about your personality versus character? I mean, they're very different.
It is, but part of the citizen's ethic idea is that it really matters how we live, what we're like, who we are. And when we start thinking like that, we also then start thinking about what politicians are like, who they are. The MP scandal becomes part of this thing. Whereas really we want to be having an argument about, like, as Madeleine said, like, about what they do.
Yeah.
And it may be that the politicians who do best aren't the ethical ones, in a sense. There's no guarantee of that. I mean, Obama is an ethical politician in many ways. Sandel is attracted to him. He speaks that language. Is Obama going to succeed in reforming healthcare? Who knows? But to me, that's the justice question.
Whether so you'd you reform like a Lyndon Johnson character who's a very unattractive, immoral person.
Exactly, or even
civil rights through.
Obama versus Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton didn't look like the ethical politician. She's a kind of grubby politician in many ways. But who knows? It may be that those are the politicians, the ones who know how it works, who can get the reforms through that allow us to lead more ethical lives. There could be a mismatch.
Well, it's a similar thing with the Ashcroft question, Madeleine. You've got a situation where David Cameron sets a lot of store by his character and about being trustworthy, but you have a situation where at some point somebody seems to have misled somebody else, and yet there's no ability to it's the politics versus ethics question, political action versus ethical judgment, which means that if David Cameron came out tomorrow and said Michael Ashcroft will give £10 million for a living wage across Whitehall, he will make that transaction, some kind of translation of the wrong he has done, because there has to have been a lie at some point. Somebody didn't know, somebody knew more than they were saying for the last 10 years. So the Ashcroft question is a display of this lack of ethics.
I kind of feel there's quite a lot of complicated issues kind of wrapped up in this, because I think what's happened is our if you like, we have an appetite for ethical debate. We always do. But what has happened is it's migrated into a kind of minute and sort of analysis of individual people's behavior, politicians' behavior, instead of where it really needs to be, which is that actually we've been through the biggest economic crisis of 60 years, and we're going to have to start paying for it. And that is going to mean that, you know, all week we've heard about the potential for cuts, you know, 500,000 people unemployed, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's really, those are the big issues. Am I interested in Ashcroft? Of course I am, because it's about a political culture in which, you know, it's clearly everybody has to contribute to the public purse, and that means you should do so through the tax system, etc.
But you think it's a leading by example question?
Well, I think one of the real problems in our political culture is that, you know, that's a recipe for doing nothing, because politicians are flawed creatures and they're going to have all kinds of shortcomings and stuff. Instead of zeroing in on the shortcomings, you know, pick them off one by one. Gordon Brown's got a temper. That means he's no longer suitable in Downing Street. You know, I find this really dispiriting, because actually we're all living in glass houses at that point. Everybody's got tempers. Everybody, you know,
but it's very different to say somebody's got a temper problem from saying somebody has A, clearly misled somebody at some stage over a 10-year period. B, they have an official role within the Conservative Party and do appear to have bought their influence. Are ethical questions of relevance to other people.
I'm not disputing that this is a relevant political story. Not for a minute. But what I'm saying is that we've pursued those kinds of questions of political wrongdoing and we've neglected the really big substantive issues.
David.
Yeah, for me, the ethical question here is that it reinforces the impression that the really rich don't pay tax. And that is an ethical question, because it is actually part of the conservative worldview. George Osborne, when he initially proposed raising the threshold on inheritance tax, he said the reason he's doing it is that really rich people don't pay it anyway, because they get lawyers and accountants to avoid it. And rather than then saying we should make them pay,
yeah.
he then says no one should have to pay it.
Yeah.
And it's that anti-tax question that comes out of this. The reason the Conservatives, in a way, are comfortable with the Ashcroft worldview is that it reinforces the idea that none of us should be paying that much tax. And that's an ethical question. It's not who lied to who. It's that idea is pervasive in the Tory party, and I think it's a dangerous idea.
And isn't there a really striking contrast here between Cameron's very rough justice to the backwoodsman who'd claimed for a duck island or whatever it was, and then the kind of tolerance of the idea that this affront to Michael Ashcroft's wealth of him paying some tax was something that could be kind of lived with and indulged for 10 years. That is a very interesting distinction, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's a reflection of that obsession with the minutiae of character questions. The duck island is emblematic of that. And the big question of tax, solidarity, are we all in this together or not? Which is a question of fundamental political ethics. And Ashcroft symbolises that.
Madeline, can I just ask, just come back to this point, that if it's not religion out of which we come to understand ethics, which we probably all agree with around this table, and if it's not political classes who are very high profile and about whom we fill our newspapers and we talk on these podcasts, etc. Where is the forum in which these ethics are debated? I'm not suggesting that the kitchen table is not a perfectly adequate place, but how do we have that national conversation if we've lost those two kind of role model groups?
I think that's a really, really good question. And what the citizen ethics was about saying is that this is, if we've sort of decided we don't want the authority of religious institutions telling us what the kind of ethical principles of our lives are, if we no longer trust politicians to do this effectively, well, it's time we have to take responsibility for ourselves. This is not a reason to just give up,
no.
but actually to think, okay, so, I use my own capacities for ethical reasoning, and that we all participate in that debate and culture. So the thing about the citizen ethics was really saying that this is a vital area of public debate and that everybody just has to get stuck in. And, you know, Mary Warnock, I think, was sort of really making this point very clearly when she said, you know, the danger here is that because we really are hostile to religion and authority, we actually lose the baby with the bathwater and we throw the whole lot out and we stop that kind of what is a good life, what is a well-lived life, these kind of really big questions.
And you have policies, don't you, David, sometimes just being settled in Whitehall by cost-benefit analysis, which claims to be neutral but is actually full of assumptions about how what people buy in a market is the only judge of what's any good. I mean, do you sense, like Madeline does, that there is something quite big afoot here, possibly after the credit crunch, which is that people want to see more explicit recognition that there are ethical choices being made, not just managerialism?
Yeah, no, I do, absolutely. But I do agree that the problem is the forum for doing it, because in a way, a lot of this makes most sense at the local level or as a debate. It's a face-to-face thing. It's about talking. The one thing that is clear to me, I think, is that the forum it's not going to happen on is the internet. It's not. There were hopes once upon a time that we could all talk to each other, and now we can all have these wonderful conversations about our values. And all we do is shout at each other. This stuff, the difficulty is translating it from, and a lot of the examples in your pamphlet are from local politics. At the local level, this makes a lot of sense. At the national level, it's really hard to find the forum. It's not going to happen in the leaders' debates. It doesn't really happen on television. It happens sometimes in newspapers, but not often. It doesn't happen on the internet. Where does it happen? And it maybe is an argument for localism. I'm not sure, but I think it might be.
Well, that is it for this week, I'm afraid. For more on the Citizens Ethics series, please visit Comment is Free on The Guardian's website.
Politics Weekly was produced by Francesca Panetta. We'll be back next week. And until then,
goodbye.
Goodbye.